It's the Bill Murphy Show. A daily one-on-one 30-minute interview featuring people from all walks of life. Available daily as a podcast at BillMurphyShow.com. And now, here's your host, Bill Murphy.
Now, I had to wait for my favorite little lick in there to get going on this before we start talking. The great guitar work you're listening to is the work of my guest for the podcast for Friday, June 11th, 2010. I've got Godfrey Townsend on the phone with me. How's it going, buddy?
Oh, it's going great. Thanks, man. How about you?
I'm really glad you took the time to talk to me. The song, by the way, that we were just listening to is called The Pump 2.5. Appropriately enough, because it has that Jeff Beck sound, specifically from that song, The Pump. I'm taking it that that's an obvious tribute to Jeff Beck there.
Yes, that's what it was. That's what it was meant to be.
And how do you come up with 2.5 as opposed to The Pump 2?
Well, that was actually your brother's idea, Steve Murphy.
Really?
Yeah, kind of. Well, what happened was, I had originally named it The Pump 2.
Okay.
After The Pump, figuring that this can be like a sequel or whatever.
That sounds right to me.
In some kind of way. And then I got a solo album of Mo Foster, who was the bass player, on the There and Back album.
Okay.
Jeff Beck's There and Back album, and he played on that song and whatever. And he had a version, another one called The Pump 2,
which was
on his solo album, which featured him on bass, Gary Moore on guitar, and Simon Phillips on drums.
So, not a bad lineup there.
Not too shabby. So then I changed it to The Pump 3.
Okay.
And then your brother said, well, you know, nowadays with all these software versions and stuff like that, why don't you just make it The Pump 2.5?
Excellent. Excellent idea.
So that's how that came about.
Version 2.5, and then if you do another one, it can be 2.5.1, you know?
That's right. Just log in for your upgrade.
So you mentioned Steve. My brother Steve was not only the drummer on that record, but also did most of the producing of that as well.
Yeah. He was my partner in crime. He was my sounding board most of the time because, you know, the tunes that were on that album I had been working on for almost 30 years.
Oh, really?
Yeah.
God, and we thought Pink Floyd took a long time to do The Wall, huh?
Uh-huh. Well, besides being a procrastinator, I just never thought anything was broadcast quality worthy or whatever, you know.
Right.
And I just, you know, and once he got to hear some of the stuff, and he would call me up in the middle of the night raving about it, you know. So,
not only that, but you compare now to 10 or 15, 20, even 20 years ago, of how much of a task it would have been to get something like this accomplished, and obviously
Right. Technology's
made it easier for you to do it now.
Right. That's why it was never really a reality for me, because I never thought I'd be able to get into a professional studio and record, you know, masters for this stuff. I thought I was really high tech when I got my Sansui 6-track cassette.
Right.
And I was going, wow, I can use one track for MIDI sync, you know, SMPTE.
You're right. Oh, exactly. Then you're really just looking at a five-track recorder at that point.
Right.
Godfrey Townsend is our guest, and it is the Pump 2.5 was the piece of music you heard. I wanted to make sure everybody knows that's from the Easy Journey to Other Planets CD, available online, I guess, at iTunes and CD Baby and record stores near you, or near Godfrey's house, anyway.
Yeah, I got 800 of them in my garage.
completely independent, and that's why, you know, we like having people like you on this show. You did that independently, and it's doing well for you, and we're doing this show completely. I'm doing it by myself, basically, out of my second bedroom, and you know, that's the kind of things we can do these days. I want to go over some of the who's who of rock and roll, of people you've played with over the years. The list goes on and on. I have just a sampling of it. Jack Bruce, Dave Mason, Alan Parsons, Ann Wilson, Todd Rundgren, Christopher Cross, Mark Farner. Godfrey, this is ridiculous. It sounds like you're name dropping here. Joey Molland, Denny Lane from Wings. And that's no joke. You were actually on stage and even in the studio with these guys at one time or another.
Worked extensively with all those people. You left out John Entwistle.
Well, I was going to save him for last and talk at length about John. But
Yeah. They actually just had people been emailing me all night. Hey, I just saw you on TV with John Entwistle. The Ox's Tale was on the Ovation Channel again tonight. It airs every couple of weeks or whatever.
Oh, that's awesome. The late, great John Entwistle. Now, you get that phone call to go work with John Entwistle. First of all, how does that go? And then also tell me, did you feel a little bit of pressure maybe about filling the shoes of Pete Townsend?
Believe it or not, I'm kind of an obnoxious guy like that. I didn't feel any pressure at all.
Ooh, there you go.
I was totally, you know, when it comes to things like that, I mean, I'm a fan just like everybody else, but when it comes to certain things like that, for some reason I have this courage that just comes out of nowhere.
Wow.
I don't know how, but, you know, I had jammed with him at the China Club back in 1994, he had just come from Carnegie Hall from singing, from playing bass at Daltrey Sings Townsend, big tribute to Pete Townsend that went on at Carnegie Hall. And Entwistle was down there performing, and he came up to the China Club where we were the house band and came and sat in with us.
Wow.
Yeah, and brought along a bunch of the other guests that were on the show that night too, like Eddie Vedder and Pino Palladino, and Phil Palmer was playing guitar, and Linda Perry was singing, and Simon Townsend.
All right, well, you're a courageous dude, but there had to have been some kind of a thrill to see these guys walk on stage with you.
Yeah, I mean, it was pretty amazing. We were, you know, from being the house band at the China Club at what they call the Pro Jam on Wednesday nights. It was like whoever was in town, you know, any kind of celebrity or famous musician or whatever who was in town might show up, and, you know, we knew a lot of tunes, and they'd get up and sit in with us. So we were kind of used to that happening, but not someone of John Entwistle's caliber. That was pretty much the cream of the crop there, you know.
And then, so how does that evolve into you working with him regularly after that?
Well, we kind of just, I mean, he walked up on stage, we shook hands, hey, how are you? And we kind of just went into 2 hours worth of Who songs.
Wow.
To a packed house. And I sang most of the stuff. And that was 1994. That was February of 1994. And I had later on gotten a gig out in Laughlin, Nevada in September of 95. And that was a three-month-long stay. And at the end of that three months, it was kind of New Year's, I had gotten a call that he wanted to put a solo band together to tour with, and he enjoyed playing with me and wanted me to be the singer and guitar player.
Jeez.
Yeah, and I mean, you know, at first it was just a guitar player, and they were going to have Jolynn Turner as a singer.
Okay. Jolynn Turner of Rainbow fame.
Rainbow, Deep Purple, Rainbow.
Right.
Yngwie. I guess it wasn't in the budget to have Jolynn as a singer because I got a call back like less than a week later, asking me, hey, do you think you can handle the lead vocals too?
Wow.
And I went, I've been singing these songs my whole life, so I guess so.
And did you end up doing a record with him, a record or two?
Yes, we did. We did a studio album of 14 tracks. Three unused tracks are still floating around.
Okay.
And then there's a live album that we did while we were on tour. And after he passed away, they came out with the definitive deluxe version of, you know, a two CD set of the, all the stuff that he didn't want put out on it.
Oh, okay.
In that one, you know. There's two versions of that, John Entwistle Band Left for Live. There's a Left for Live and Left for Live Deluxe. And there's a studio album called Music from Vampires, which was a computer-generated cartoon show that was on Saturday mornings on Fox 5.
Oh, wow.
Yeah, it was kind of a cool new thing, and it was we wrote a song for each episode, wrote the theme tune for the show, and that came out as an album called Music for Vampires. And there was some screw-up with the record company, of course, and the thing was never officially released, but it's out there available either on his website or whatever, you know.
Nowadays, people can find a way to dig that stuff up if they just try a little bit, that's all.
Yeah, I mean, I don't get any money for it, so I might just post it all up on my site for free download.
Why not? Great for the portfolio. It's Music Friday on the Bill Murphy Show. Every Friday we showcase another musician or a band. So if you're interested in getting your music heard and talked about and your gigs promoted, contact me at murph@billmurphyshow.com and we'll get you on a future edition of Music Fridays. We're talking to Godfrey Townsend, who is actually you're doing a tour right now. You're in the middle, I guess you're in between legs of a tour of the Happy Together tour, which features some other big names that I didn't mention earlier.
Well, I mean, these are more like 60s acts, you know, your AM radio guys, you know.
Stars nonetheless, though.
Yeah. I mean, the Buckinghams, kind of a drag.
Right.
That was a pretty big one, wasn't it?
Not bad.
Yeah. And then we got the Grassroots.
Excellent.
Which, you know, Midnight Confessions. I can remember borrowing my friend's aunt's Emily organ, you know, for a little gig I did to play the organ part for Midnight Confessions.
Wow.
So that's the Grassroots, Midnight Confessions. Then we got Mark Lindsay from Paul Revere and the Raiders. He was the singer of Paul Revere and the Raiders.
Of course.
And we're doing a bunch of tunes with him. Pretty cool. Hungry, Kicks, you know, his later solo stuff or whatever, like Arizona or
Indian Reservation.
Indian Reservation is in there in the set. And then we have Mickey Dolenz from the Monkees.
The great Mickey Dolenz.
Yeah. Who is unbelievable. I mean, he's a hell of a nice guy, really informative, fun to sit and talk to, and tells you a whole bunch of great old stories and things and, you know, facts and stuff you didn't know. And then he gets on stage and he sings his butt off.
Wow. At what age? I mean, do we even want to say? I mean, it's amazing to think.
I mean, these guys all got to be in their late 60s.
Amazing, amazing.
Mm-hmm.
And occasionally you'll see artists go out at an age like that and you think, well, you know what? Maybe they should have packed it in a long time ago, but not these guys that you're playing with. They've got
they've got it going on, man, I'll tell you. Flo and Eddie from the Turtles, they closed the show. And you know, Happy Together and She'd Rather Be With Me and Eleanor, you know, these are songs that are just etched in the brain. It's kind of like the soundtrack to my youth, that's for sure.
Well, I was going to say, it's probably really easy for you to play this stuff because this is the music you learned how to play guitar on.
Yep.
I also want to get into another tour that you've got coming up later in the summer, but we'll talk about that later in the show.
Mm-hmm.
Right now, I want to go ahead and dig back. I want to get a little of the biography here, so we're going to go back into your memory. Godfrey, I'm hoping that you can do this, but can you actually remember the first time you ever picked up a guitar at a very young age?
Yeah, sure. I mean, obviously it wasn't mine, probably, right? It was somebody else's. You know, I can remember what my first guitar was. I actually just found another one on eBay and bought it just for posterity, you know?
Oh, there you go.
You know, I mean, I started playing piano originally.
Okay. Didn't we all, though? Didn't we
all? Yeah, I mean, my mom played piano. My uncle's in Europe, you know. My mother comes from the island of Malta, which is in the Mediterranean Sea there, a little south of Sicily. And we used to go over there every couple of summers or whatever to visit for a while, and they had pianos, and I'd be sitting there banging around on the keys, you know, melodies by ear. And, right. You know, my uncle told my mother, you should get a piano and let him take lessons. He's got an ear. And that's what happened. And then, of course, along come the Beatles, you know.
Oh, well, everything goes back to the Beatles, you know.
Yeah, of course.
I don't think there's a musician out there that doesn't have the Beatles as part of their story, so.
Yeah, I mean, I can remember my dad calling me into the living room saying, hey, you might want to see this, and there's the Beatles getting off the plane, you know, at the airport, and everybody screaming.
Wow.
And, yeah, I can totally remember that night or day or whatever. And I can also remember sitting in my hallway in our apartment building, looking at the cover of the picture sleeve for Rain and Paperback Writer.
Wow.
And just looking at the Beatles playing their guitars, their Gretches and Rickenbackers, and just going, that's kind of what I want to do.
Yeah, there you go.
Making that decision, it's like it clicked on in my head, like, this is what I want to do. And I got my Tiger, M&E Tiger guitar, which was basically a plastic guitar, but it came with a plastic amp.
And that was the first one that you had?
Yeah, that was the first one. You know, didn't stay in tune very well, if I even knew how to tune it. And then I, at my music school where I was taking piano lessons, my mother bought me a real electric guitar and an amplifier. It was like $50 at the time for the guitar and the amp. And believe it or not, it was an Ibanez guitar.
Was it really? Didn't even know they were around then. That's
right, but it was like, you know, it looked like a cheap Japanese model, you know, like one of those Tiscos or whatever. But it was an Ibanez.
Jeez.
And that was my first electric guitar. And so then I started learning how to play by just getting sheet music with the little chord diagrams on them and, you know, strumming along.
I don't know if you can put yourself in the shoes of people like myself that we try to be really good guitar players, but there's just a skill that is got to be involved, a coordination that I did just you try and try and try, practice, and you can't get it. I'm a very less than mediocre guitar player, and no matter how hard I try, some of it just comes naturally. And I mean, at what point did you go, wow, this is, I might be able to get really, really good at this? Do you remember a point in time where it was, all right, here we go?
I don't remember thinking that. I just remember just loving to play.
Right.
And just wanting to play all the time and just having an interest. It was like a passion. It was an ambition to sit down and figure out exactly what that riff is, you know, exactly what that note is, you know, that he's playing, you know, oh, you know, and of course in the old days it was a lot harder because he had a turntable,
right,
with a needle on a tone arm that you had to keep lifting off and putting back in place to hear it over and over again. Not like today, kids can just, you know, put something on their digital recorders or whatever and loop it
if they want, right.
Slow it down without changing the pitch, you know, all this kind of stuff, you know. It's like amazing. Back then, you had to have a quick ear, and you had to have a quick hand.
Skilled fingers with the tone arm, right. Unbelievable.
Yeah. And so, you know, I mean, I didn't really know anything more than just that I wanted to do this, that this is what I wanted to do, and I loved doing it. And when I was doing it, I felt like I was being who I was supposed to be, you know?
Wow.
Only till years later that people were telling me that I was good, that, you know, I started thinking, oh, maybe I'm good at this, you know? So, oh, okay, well, you think that? Okay, great. I'll keep doing this then, you know?
You've shared some great stories with me over the years. Not only did you sit in front of, you know, stereos with turntables learning licks from your heroes, but you also got to witness some incredible concerts in your day, and I'm sure that was very inspirational to you, and I'm sure you were there for a reason as well. as you were chasing the dream and you wanted to see the greats in action. Share one or two of these amazing stories. Let's start with seeing Led Zeppelin live, something that many, many, many of us did not get to do.
Did you read the story on my website?
Well, I think I've heard it from you personally, but I'm going to pretend that I didn't hear the story and just tell it to me.
You know, we're talking about decades ago. Of course, I was young, but I was still kind of ahead of the game because I was into music that maybe older people were into.
Right.
And so we were going to see Led Zeppelin, me and my two friends, and it was 1970 or 71, something like that.
I just have to laugh at how amazing that is.
Yeah, at Madison Square Garden. And we were so young that, you know, people were smoking pot all around us. And we thought we were going to get arrested because of that.
Because like, you were just there.
They were going to arrest the whole section, you know. and then the next year, I went to see them again at Madison Square Garden. And I had gotten a pair of tickets. My girlfriend and I, there was a local record store where we used to go and hang around a lot. And there's a sign in the window saying, you know, pair of Led Zeppelin tickets for sale, inquire within or whatever. You know, and we went in, and they said, yeah, we got them. And these were orchestra seats, second row orchestra.
Unbelievable.
In Madison Square Garden, and this was 1971. And they were selling them for face value, which was $7.50.
It would be $750 now, easily.
Right. So we got two second row orchestra seats for Led Zeppelin for $15. And, you know, of course, we didn't have any money. We didn't have any jobs or anything. And we just went around grubbing and finding bottles and cans to, you know, bring in for the deposits and stuff like that, and running errands for you know, neighbors. And we came up with the money, and we went in and got them. And we didn't even know they were second row. And, you know, so anyway, we're at the concert. And of course, as soon as Zeppelin comes out, everybody just rushes the stage.
So your advantage of having second row was just thrown out the window right there.
But we were right there anyway, so we kind of jumped up in the, you know, we were pretty close and pretty much hanging off the front of the stage for the first half of the concert.
Unbelievable.
Just hanging off the front of the stage, and I can remember having my legs tucked around a beam that was under the stage, kind of sitting on it, and with my elbows up on the, right up on the stage, five feet away from Paige.
And so, so you were on Paige's side of the stage.
On Paige's side.
Unbelievable.
And then at one point, my legs were getting really tired. I was getting tired of holding on. So I actually climbed up onto the stage and sat on his wedge monitor. Because there was just kids climbing onto the stage and hanging out all over the place. And at one point, there were so many people on the stage that the front of the stage collapsed.
Okay, this is where the story gets a little ugly.
The front of the stage collapsed, and of course, people and wedge monitors and whatever else started rolling off into the crowd.
Oh, man.
And believe it or not, I mean, Zeppelin just, like, went off stage for a couple of minutes. And they came back out, you got to be cool, man. You know, and they just continued to play.
Unbelievable.
And it's actually in the Hammer of the Gods book.
That story of that stage collapsing, huh?
Yep, it's in the Hammer of the Gods book, and it's talks about how Richard Cole was along the front of the stage doing karate kicks to kick kids off the stage and all this stuff.
Wow. And
I was right there.
Well, it was kind of a mess, but not quite the mess that the people who tried to go to see them in Tampa went through, which I've heard a couple of stories of people that were there, but that is just something else to see that show there. How many times did you end up seeing them live?
Zeppelin I saw live about four or five times.
That's insane. That's crazy.
Maybe 75 and 77. But, you know, even the first time I saw them was pretty incredible because it was a matinee concert. And I just went on Zeppelin.com a couple of weeks ago, and there's a whole bunch of posters and promos from all their gigs. And there's a poster for that actual concert that says matinee and evening shows at Madison Square Garden. And what's pretty funny is that I had seen Paige for the first time, and here he is doing the thing with the violin bow, right?
Right.
And I'm totally mesmerized. Like, what is going on here? And I actually, it was a matinee concert, so I was home by 4 or 5 o'clock in the afternoon. I had to play a block party that night. And my uncle had given me a violin.
Uh-oh.
And I had this old violin in a case that I never really took out. But I took the violin bow and put it in my guitar case and took it to the block party.
And just tried it. Just went for it.
Why not? Let me try this. And here I am going, you know, in the middle of some song, and everybody's looking at me like, what the hell are you doing, man?
Wow.
That's and I was, you know, well, this guy was doing it this afternoon, and it sounded good when he did it.
This guy was doing it this afternoon.
I saw this guy do it this afternoon, and he made it sound good.
It's funny, you tell this story, and as I'm picturing it in my head, I can only picture it in black and white, because all the footage I've seen of that that era of Zeppelin was in black and white, but I'm sure it was in living color for you.
Right. I mean, you know, the first concert was kind of like when you see that 69 stuff from, like, Denmark or whatever, you know, where they're just really raw. That was the first. I mean, just white lights, come out and play for 3 hours or whatever, you know.
You were seeing something that had never been done before, and obviously they were going off in sections of songs and all these improvisational parts that didn't. I'm sure you picked up on that. I've seen you live, and you know how to go off on a tangent on songs. So that was a great start for that. Is this something that you try to encourage the bands that you play with now to do, like extend a section so that everybody can kind of, you know, do their thing?
Yeah, well, you know, I mean, one thing that I remember that was always a pretty cool thing was that we always wound up like just learning. It's kind of like learning a language, you know. You learn a phrase, you learn another phrase, you learn another phrase, you learn another phrase, you learn some key words, and you can speak a language pretty much.
Right.
So what we would do is you learn all the real riffs off the studio versions, and then you go into the live versions and you see how they improvised on it or how they changed it around a little bit or whatever, and then you just play it like you think they would play it live, you know.
You're sort of a one of the Manhattan's musical heroes. You go into the B.B. King's and play all the time. You're a big star there, and you put on a lot of these shows. And I know my brother plays drums with you on a lot of these concerts that you do, whether it's for a Clapton gig. You do a regular Eric Clapton tribute show. So you've worked hand-in-hand with my little brother Steve Murphy a lot, and I know that Paige and Bonham really worked off of each other a lot. There's a lot of eye contact in the old footage that you watch with them, hand signals from Paige, and Bonham kind of leading Paige into a different direction. So I imagine with the many, many years that you and Steve have with each other that there's a little bit of that going on as well.
There's totally that going on. Him and I play off each other completely.
And sometimes you don't even have to look at him. You can just feel where he's going with it. So
I know where he's going. He knows where I'm going. He even does that on my album. If you can hear certain riffs where I do a riff and he follows me on the drums or gives me some kind of an answer or like a compliment to what I just played, he'll do like a drum fill that kind of echoes it or whatever, you know?
Wow.
He's
a pretty good drummer, huh, Steve?
I think so. You know what I mean?
I think so. His list of people that he's played with is very similar to yours. Of course, you've acted as the backline together with a lot of these artists as well.
Funny enough, I mean, I brought him onto the I did that Walk Down Abbey Road tour in 2001 was with John Entwistle, Alan Parsons, Ann Wilson, and Todd Rundgren. And the next summer, Entwistle was supposed to be going out with The Who, so they were getting Jack Bruce to play bass, and they were bringing Mark Farner on there, and a few other different names, but it was going to be Todd Rundgren and Alan Parsons again. Now, I became the musical director for the thing, so I'm talking with the producer of the tour, saying, I have a drummer I want to bring on the tour for this summer. And he kept insisting to me, well, Mark Farner wants to bring his drummer. And I just kept saying, well, I'm the musical director, no? So I'm in charge of making sure that everything happens on stage that's supposed to happen for every one of the artists.
Right.
How do you expect me to work with someone who I don't even know how they play? I never heard Mark Farner's drummer. I don't know him. I don't know what he's capable of. But I could tell you about this guy.
Right. And there was that. You knew that would be one less band member that you would have to worry about when you were putting the arrangements together.
Yeah. And the way I finally sold it to him... was I told him, remember last summer, all the high parts that we gave Ann Wilson?
Right. He can sing them.
I said, well, this summer, this drummer can sing those parts.
Oh, that's great. And that's just fantastic stuff, Godfrey. I know you have like millions and millions of concert stories that you could tell us, but we're running out of time. It's amazing how fast this 30 minutes goes by. It's Music Friday, and we're with Godfrey Townsend, who is the artist of the music we played at the top of the show. It's Easy Journey to Other Planets. That was, what, 2007 you released that?
2007, right.
And is there,
we're gonna repackage it and release it again.
And is there a new one in the works? Are you gonna get a follow up to that one going?
Yes, we are. We are working on a new album right now, and we're putting together material for it, as well as writing some new material for it. And this one's going to have vocals on it.
Oh, wow. Yeah, in case anybody was wondering, that is an all-instrumental album for the most part. 98.3%
right.
of it is. So that's a la Joe Satriani, who else? Any like an old Jeff Beck classic album, that kind of music. And also, quickly, before we talk about the tour that you're going on later in the summer, the attachment you have to Eric Clapton. I know you do a Clapton is Godfrey show, cleverly named, and it plays often at B.B. King's, and a lot of your licks are very Eric Clapton-ish, so I would say one of your top three influences, is that somebody that you haven't gotten to play with yet, or did you have an opportunity to play with Eric at any point?
Never had an opportunity to play with Eric. Ran into him once, years ago, going into the Bottom Line in New York City to see Jack Bruce. I was going to the late show, and he had just jammed with Jack for the early show, and he was walking out, and I was walking in.
Wow.
So I had just missed him, yeah.
Did you get to say hi to him at least? Or?
Yes.
Okay. So do you think that'll ever happen? Do you ever think you'll get to be on the same stage with Eric Clapton and trade licks?
You know what? Stranger things have happened, right?
We've talked about a lot stranger things already in this show.
There was many nights that I looked over across the stage and went, wow, that's the bass player from The Who, man.
Yeah, right, exactly. Even if it's like your 10th show, I guess stuff like that just hits you over and over again, I guess.
Mm-hmm.
The tour coming up later this summer is Hippie Fest. Talk a little bit about that and who will we be seeing this time around. It's actually going to be down this way in South Florida again, right?
Oh, yeah, we're doing, are we doing Broward? Yeah, we're doing Broward. And Ruth Eckerd in Clearwater.
Okay.
I believe those are the two Florida venues that we'll be doing.
And what's the one lineup this time?
So this is called Hippie Fest, and it started in 2006. This year, we'll be backing up Mitch Ryder from Detroit Wheels.
Right.
Joey Mollins from Badfinger, who we've worked with for many years now. And War and Rare Earth are also on the show, bringing their own bands. But we'll also be backing up Jack Bruce from Cream.
Oh, sort of reuniting with Jack. And how's Jack doing? I heard he had a little health issue. Is he back up and doing well?
Yeah, I mean, he had some health issues. He's had some major health issues and kind of got a second chance on life there.
Wow.
Was in a coma with a liver transplant, and his body rejected it, and then they gave him another liver, and he came out of it.
Oh, I had no idea it was that bad. Wow.
Yeah, and that was right before the Cream reunion.
Wow.
I mean, he literally came out of a coma, and on his hospital bed was offered the Cream reunion tour.
That'll get somebody up and running again.
Yeah. So he basically got his life back, and became a millionaire all over again. You know, whatever.
Good morning, Jack. We're putting the band back together.
Yep. So we worked with him after that. We did a summer out on Hippie Fest with him. Jack had played on the Walk Down Abbey Road tour with me and Steve many years ago, 2002, and he also asked us to do a couple of side shows with him after that. And we were meant to do a 2 or 3 week tour with him in the spring of last year, but he went back in the hospital with some kind of kidney infection or something like that. So that was canceled. So hopefully his health will hold up, God willing, and we'll be able to do this tour. It's not going to be that hard. It's going to be maybe a week out, a week home and then 2 weeks out again or something like that, you know.
Godfrey Townsend, thank you so much for joining me. His record is Easy Journey to Other Planets. Look for it online at iTunes. You can even find it at godfreytownsendmusic.com or even on my site, murphonics.com. We've got some links to find that record as well. Any websites or places people can go to find out if Hippie Fest or Happy Together is going to be stopping in their city?
Godfrey Townsend Music. Called Upcoming Gigs and Tours. You just click on that, and up comes my whole schedule, and all the dates that are for Happy Together and for Hippie Fest are on there.
Awesome. Looking forward to seeing you at one of these gigs before the summer is out. Godfrey Townsend, my good buddy, on this June 11th edition of Music Friday and Bill Murphy Show. We'll leave him up all weekend long if you want to relive this and listen to the music again. And then we'll have another edition to the Bill Murphy Show on Monday. Thank you, Godfrey. Sir.
I'll be back anytime you want me.
Appreciate that.
Log on each weekday for another edition of The Bill Murphy Show at BillMurphyShow.com. If you'd like to be a guest, send an email to Murph@BillMurphyShow.com. That's M-U-R-P-H at BillMurphyShow.com. A Murphonics Media Production.